Instinctively, man has always been drawn to the sea. Its beauty, its mystery, its secrets. But there is also a vague uncertainty, a sense of intrusion into an alien world, where man is unwelcome and completely at the mercy of the most terrifying predator on Earth. Man's deepest fear has risen again. Jaws, the revenge. This time, it's personal.
Hello, and welcome to Unloved Sequels, the podcast that brings you a blow-by-blow critique of Hollywood's worst-rated movies. You know, the ones that some people think should never have been made. We're your hosts. Michael, say hello.
Hello.
And I'm Claire. In this episode, it's personal. Michael, we're suspending disbelief more than ever before, I think, for what is evidently one of your favourite bad movies. Or is it just one of your favourite movies? Michael, do tell.
This week, we are discussing one of my favourite unloved sequels, Claire. You are correct. We're jumping on a plane, heading down to the Bahamas with the Brody family and a plastic shark that can only be described as meh. This is Jaws of Revenge. I'm so excited to talk about this film.
Well, that makes one of us.
But Clay, don't forget, this is the final nail in the Jaws coffin, so there is no Jaws movies after this. We've wrapped Jaws up completely after this episode.
I know. So that means we never have to talk about Jaws movies again.
Yes, we will. I'm hoping that
brilliant.
I'm hoping that the podcast comes become so successful that we have to do that touring idea I had a couple of episodes ago, and we have to go around different countries doing screenings of movies and do a discussion like Jaws of Revenge. What do you think? Yeah? No? Making people watch Jaws of Revenge?
Wait, so with this tour you're talking about, we're going to pin it on Jaws of Revenge?
Oh,
that's the movie that's going to front our international tour.
There's an audience for this film.
No, you are the audience for this film. Who's going to come and watch you talk about a movie that only you want to watch?
This has quite a big following now. It's got like a cult following.
Has it? Has it?
It has. It's got a big cult following.
Okay,
let's get on with it. And we're going to fall out of it. Yeah. Okay, so Jaws of Revenge was released on July the 17th, 1987. In its opening weekend, the film grossed just over $7 million, almost half of what Jaws 3D had grossed in its first weekend. So they're like, Jaws of Revenge was only in the top 10 for 2 weeks, then dropped to number 2 in its third week by the end of its theatrical run, and then they pulled it from the movie theatre.
So it only ran for 3 weeks?
Basically.
Wow.
So they were like, oh, this is not doing what we're supposed to be doing. Let's move on. So box office wise, it ended up, you know what? I'm going to break it down a little bit more detailed than normal because I think I'm going to give this film a fair shot compared to other movies we talk about. So box office wise, in America, it took just under 21 million, what was 40% of its overall total. Internationally, it took 60% of its overall total with 31 million. To make a worldwide box office of just under 52 million. So I don't think that bad on a budget of 23 million. So compared to most films we talk about, it turned a profit. It didn't flop.
Yes. But compared to earlier movies in the Jaws franchise, which is presumably what the studio was looking at.
Yes, this is true.
It's not competing at all, is it?
Well, no, it has dropped, but most franchises do.
Yeah.
If we look at, I'm just going to go off subject for a bit, first of all. If we look at other horror franchises that were big in the 80s, Nightmare on Elm Street, Part 5 had a budget of $8 million. That ended up taking $22
million.
That's a terrible return, but they carried on making them.
Yeah.
Jason X, what came out afterwards, has a budget of $14 million and made $20 million. So these franchises don't have to be you know, it's still making a bigger percentage than any of these other horror franchises that are still being made today. So for me, I'm like, why does Jaws Revenge get such a hard time? But we're going to talk more about that.
Well, stay tuned, listeners.
So adjusted for inflation, the box office for today's money would be $138 million. Well, I think that's not a bad turnout. Looking at the box office chart for 1987, I can't find a correct one online. They vary so much. Some just include the domestic total. Like Box Office Mojo has it down at like 15 million and it's just a bit of a hot mess at the moment. No one's really got the figures together. So what I did was I went and looked at the top 10 movies for that year. And I'm going to read them to you now in descending order, starting with the highest grossing. The highest grossing movie of 1987 was Three Men and a Baby, followed by Fatal Attraction, Beverly Hills Cop 2, Good Morning Vietnam, Moonstruck, The Untouchables, The Secrets of My Success, Stakeout, Lethal Weapon, and at number 10, Witches of Eastwick. Excellent.
There's some really punchy movies there.
There is. I'm also actually going to mention number 11. It's a film that I thought did better than it did. Number 11, Dirty Dancing.
Ah.
Well, I think it's quite shocking because I thought, imagine that being in the top three or four that year, because it's such a cult classic now and it's a lot of people's favorite movie.
Yeah,
and it didn't perform, and that only took, so that Dirty Dancing took about 63 million. So
I wonder if Dirty Dancing though is one that people didn't necessarily go and see in the cinema, but then it's on home viewing, it's picked up its audience, hasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So if Dirty Dancing took about 63 million, so I'm assuming that if all of these are correct, Jaws of Revenge would have ended up around the 15th place of the year. Mm. So there is a massive downfall from the original movie, because that was the biggest
movie
of all time one time. And now it's kind of like worked its way down the list to number 15. But still, it's still not a bomb. There's a lot of franchises that have complete bomb.
Yeah.
But Jaws has this reputation of being like the worst thing in the world. And I've seen like some Elm Street films have gone completely off the rails, but people seem to be more forgiving with that than they are with the Jaws franchise.
I think the bar is lower to start with for a lot of those franchises. As much as
more of a niche,
a lot of people, and including you, and to an extent me, really love those sorts of horror franchises, none of them started off at the level that Jaws started at.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly.
So I think, you know, Jaws has got further to fall, hasn't it?
At the moment, Jaws of Revenge sits at 822 in the all-time worldwide sequel box office chart, but also sits at 397 at the horror worldwide box office. And that's out of just over 2,000 entries. So that's not bad.
No.
So I think a lot of people give this film a much harder ranking about how it performed than it actually did.
Yeah.
But here's where it goes south. It currently sits at a 0% critic score on Rotten Tomato. And a 50% audience score. The critics are ones who killed this movie more than anything. And I'm not saying, I think the zero is harsh. I think the reviews on this is harsh. And if they did look at it through the perspective of it just being a horror film and not comparing it to the first Jaws movie, then I do think that the scoring on this is really rough. Because, you know, well, we'll discuss later on more detail. But yeah, one other thing that I've got to mention is that Lorraine Gary was nominated for a Saturn Award for Best Actress, but lost to Jessica Tandy for Batteries Not Included. And she was also nominated for a Golden Raspberry Award for this.
She was.
And she lost to Madonna for Who's That Girl? So apart from that, Claire, do you have any behind-the-scenes stuff for us?
So on this movie is a continuity of the story that we've already seen, except that it sort of bypasses Jaws 3.
Yeah.
So the timeline, I mean, it's not actually explicit in the movie, but we know that Jaws happened in this continuity. And I think it's accepted that Jaws 2, I'm just trying to quickly think through, because there are various flashbacks in Revenge from the original movie. I don't recall of them being from the second. So some people, and I think you're one of them, prefer to remove Jaws 2 from this timeline as well.
So in the novelization of this film, because the novelization was written by the same person who wrote the novelization of Jaws 2, Jaws 2 is very, it's very connected.
Yeah.
But in the movie...
Isn't there a thing in the novelization that the shark in Revenge is the child of the two sharks from 1 and 2?
Yes. So the shark, the original Jaws, he was the boy shark.
Jaws was the daddy.
Jaws 2 was a pregnant shark. And then sometime in Jaws 2, she had given birth. And one of the offspring is the shark from Jaws
is Revenge. So those three films are part of this continuity.
Yes.
Jaws 3 is the alternate timeline in which we go to SeaWorld, but not in this movie. This doesn't happen in this existence. So in terms then of casting continuity, we've got Lorraine Gary in this movie playing Ellen Brody. She came out of retirement. She hadn't been in a movie since 1979. She came out of retirement to make this, having not been in Jaws 3. And this to date is her last acting role. So far, maybe she'll make another great comeback.
I don't know.
In terms of other, there are a couple of other returners. We've got Fritzi Jane Courtney coming back as Mrs. Tuff. She was in the original movie, and we've got Lee Fierro back as Mrs. Kintner, who is she had a very small part in the first movie, but her character is the mother of Alex Kintner, who was the second victim in the first film.
Yeah.
So there's a little she carries through. We've then got some archive footage of Jay Mello as young Sean. We've got some archive footage and a photograph up on the wall of Roy Scheider as Martin Brody. Roy Scheider was offered a cameo in Revenge, but he declined, stating, "Satan himself could not get me to do Jaws Part 4. Reportedly, if he had accepted the part, the idea was going to be that death at the beginning that was Sean was going to be his death. Yeah. But obviously he didn't want to do the movie, so they made it be Sean's death, and then they just used some archive footage for some of the weird little flashbacks that I think we will probably discuss flashbacks at some point later in the episode. I mean, we all know, we remember from doing our Jaws 2 episode, Roy Scheider didn't even want to make Jaws 2. He only made it because he was contractually bound to. He was completely done after the first movie with the franchise, so he had absolutely zero interest in coming back. Interestingly, Dennis Quaid was invited to reprise the part of Mike Brody from Jaws 3. So that then would have created a continuity.
Yes, big time.
There. So I guess would have brought Jaws 3 into that timeline. I don't know whether the script would have had to have been different to accommodate that, because he's got a completely different career and his brother is suddenly a police officer, that there was no indication of that going on in Jaws 3. Anyway, he declined, so they didn't have to worry about making that all work out. Bess Armstrong was also invited back to reprise her role as Catherine Morgan, who was Mike's girlfriend in Jaws 3, but she also declined. I don't know what would have happened if she'd said yes and Dennis Quaid had said no. That would have been weird, but maybe it was conditional on him coming back that she would come anyway. Neither of them did. Murray Hamilton was invited to come back as the mayor. He was the mayor in the first two movies. He wasn't in the third movie. Unfortunately, he died of cancer before filming started, so he is not in this movie. The original script for Jaws the Revenge features a cameo for Matt Hooper, who was the Richard Dreyfuss character in the original movie. There was going to be a scene where he's on the phone to the Brodies and he talks to Thea, the little girl. She calls him Uncle Matt. It kind of establishes him as still being in touch with the family, still being on quite good terms with the family. He passes on condolences over Sean's death, but he did not want to come back either. So that was cut. In terms of new cast, we have got Lance Guest playing Mike Brody. We've got Mario Van Peebles in as Jake. We've got Karen Young playing Carla Brody, who is the wife of Mike Brody. We've got Michael Caine as Hoagie. Random casting. Yeah, that was a weird bit of casting. I mean, I like it, but it's weird. And we've got Judith Barcy in as Thea, who is Mike and Carla's daughter. The movie's directed by Joseph Sargent, who directed a lot of TV movies, but not much for theatrical release. This is one of very few, and I think this is the last theatrically released movie he made. The script was by Michael de Guzman, who also did a lot of TV movies, not very many theatrical features. And of course, there is a nod for Peter Benchley, who wrote the original novel. I'm assuming he had no hand in the writing.
I don't think he had a hand in any of the Jaws sequels. I think he was... Even he sold the original book for a lot of money at the time, but I think he was bitter that he didn't get more money for it or kept hold of some of the rights.
Yeah, maybe he didn't get the deal that he thought afterwards he should have done.
Yep. Exactly.
Which is what that was the deal with. That was the issue with Roy Scheider, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That was his beef when he had to come back and make the second one, that he ended up having to negotiate a massive paycheck for the second one because he felt like he'd been underpaid for the first one, if I remember rightly.
Well, he didn't get paid, did he? He had a contract for free movies with Universal. And
yes.
And then he didn't want to do it, they said, well, we'll count Jaws 2 as two movies for you. So he got paid two movies worth of that contract.
Yes, because he wanted to get out the contract. You're absolutely right. I remember now. Yes. So MCA Universal was going through a bit of a tricky period just before this movie was made. And so CEO Sidney Sheinberg, who incidentally was married to Lorraine Gary, he saw that a third sequel to Jaws was likely to make them a good profit off the back of Jaws 3D, which, although it was critically not a huge success, it did do okay financially. So they thought, well, let's carry on with that. Let's jump on that and see if we can lift the studio's fortunes a bit with another Jaws sequel. And it also tied in as an opportunity to promote the Jaws ride at Universal Studios. So he got in touch with Joseph Sargent, asked him to direct the movie. This was in sort of late September 1986. At this point, there was no script. But basically, Sheinberg said to Sargent, look, this is your baby. You can produce it. You can direct it. And he was like, OK, fine, I'll do that. As we said, he's not had that many theatrical movies under his belt. So he's obviously taking the opportunity to do that. And so the studio got the movie underway for them. Sargent said the premise was born out of a little bit of desperation to find something fresh to do with the shark. We thought that maybe if we take a mystical point of view and go for a little bit of magic, we might be able to find something interesting enough to sit through. Now, obviously, he's talking about a load of stuff that didn't actually end up being part of the premise in the end of the movie, because what he is referring to, I assume, there was part of a deleted plot that's in the novelization about the voodoo shark thing.
Yes, the witch doctor.
The witch, that's what I'm looking for. Voodoo shark was the only phrase I could think of, because that's TV tropes have an entire trope named voodoo shark after this exact thing, which is where a plot hole gets kind of explained by something that makes no more sense than if they just left the plot hole. So the idea in the novelization and in, I guess, the original premise, I think there was going to be a fight between Mike Brody and a witch doctor who then cast a voodoo spell over a shark to make the shark hunt down Brody's family.
Yeah.
Which was an effort to make sense of the fact of what you were saying about a shark following someone who's traveling from Amity to the Bahamas, and the shark just kind of swims along. A, the shark knows that that person is the person they want to be chasing. B, that person knows that that person has got on a plane and gone to the Bahamas and isn't in Amity anymore. So they need to go to the Bahamas to find this woman. Yeah. So the more you kind of pin on that explanation, the weirder the explanation becomes. But it does kind of bring in that element of it being beyond the shark's control, which is quite, I think, is quite an interesting aspect to consider, and that the shark is hunting down these specific people for reasons that it doesn't really understand, which kind of helps with the fact of it not really making a great deal of sense. So yeah, that was a whole thing. And then that ended up getting written out of the movie anyway, presumably because they realized it didn't make sense. The studio fast-tracked Jaws the Revenge into production in September 86 so that it could be released in summer 87. The principal script by Michael Guzman, who was mostly known for TV work, as I said, it was written in 5 weeks. But as I just said, the script was not complete when filming began. One of the Universal press releases for Jaws the Revenge refers to it as the third film of the remarkable Jaws trilogy. So they are completely erasing Jaws 3 or Jaws 3D from that continuity, even the studio. So it's not just that they kind of were like, well, let's not mention any of that. Let's ignore it, pretend it didn't happen. They were actively erasing it from the story's continuity. Interestingly, though, the underwater chase scene between Mike and the shark in Jaws the Revenge was lifted from an early draft of Jaws 3D. I don't know how that scene would have fit into Jaws 3, but that's...
There's that whole sunken ship in Jaws 3 where him and
I guess it would have been from, so by the time all of this had gone on, and with the script changes and the fact the script wasn't finished when the movie started shooting, according to the director, the film had gone through so many story pitches that once they kind of settled on this idea of the shark going after the Brody family and looking for revenge, they had just got to a point where Universal agreed to it and they were like, fine, let's just make the movie. I think they kind of knew it was ridiculous, but they'd reached the point of, look, well, we need to make a movie. There has to be something. The studio have approved this premise.
Yeah.
We need to just make the movie and hope that people go with it.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Caine, there's your weird casting. I guess that's a bit of a stunt casting because he was a huge deal. I mean, he still is a huge deal.
But at the time, he was going through a career slump. This is before he won his Oscar and stuff. Matter of fact, he won his Oscar while filming Jaws of Revenge.
Yeah, I mean, there are stories, although I'm not sure they're strictly true, that the reason that he couldn't go and collect his Oscar was that he was having to reshoot the end of this movie. He was in the Bahamas. This movie is the reason that he didn't collect the Oscar, but I don't think it was specifically those reshoots.
No, it wasn't the reshoots. It was actually the filming, because the reshoots took place in LA. None of the reshoots took place in the Bahamas for this. So all the reshoots...
Oh, really?
In LA. None of the...
Even the alternative ending?
It's all tank work. If you actually watch the film closely, you can see the water hitting the scenery at the back.
Wow.
Refilmed all of it in the tank. So he was actually just filming this film.
Yeah.
Oscars.
His take on it is quite famous, actually, that he said, won an Oscar, built a house, had a great holiday. Not bad for a flop movie. He was paid $1.5 million for 7 days' work in the Bahamas. Like, the famous quote from him is something like, I haven't seen the movie. By all accounts, it's pretty bad, but I have seen the house it built. And that's marvellous, or words to that effect. This was absolutely, I mean, he made a few paycheck movies around this time. As you say, he was in a bit of a career slump. This was definitely one of those movies. The other reason he made it, though, was because he wanted to make a film that his daughter would want to see. His daughter was...
Everybody says that. It's the most common thing for an actor to say
when they make a shit film.
Like, I wanted to make a film for my children to watch. Like, you do it all the time.
What's his name? Richard E. Grant says that about Spice World, the movie. He did it because his daughter heard the message on his voicemail. She was about 8 and she was like, you have to be in this movie. The Spice Girls are amazing. But he speaks really highly of his experience of making the movie, and he has not
a
bad word to say about it. It's a great film. It is a great film. But Michael Caine, apparently his daughter was about 13, I think, at the time. Yeah. And he was like, well, she doesn't want to see any of my other films. Maybe she will want to come and see this. And, you know, $1.5 million and a trip to the Bahamas.
Yeah.
Apparently he accepted the role. He turned to the first page of the script and the first line was, fade in, Hawaii. And he was like, yes, I'm in this movie.
Hawaii?
I will do it. That's what it said, apparently.
Oh, they changed.
So whether they had changed, whether they changed the location, I guess they must have done. But he wanted to go somewhere nice and hot and sunny, so he did it.
Don't blame him.
Yeah. Michael Caine was also Razzie nominated for this movie. In fact, he's the second actor to get a Academy Award winning performance in one movie and then go straight into a Jaws sequel for which he got a Razzie nomination. It happened in Jaws 3 as well. Louis Gossett Jr., who won an Oscar for Officer and a Gentleman, then was nominated for the Razzie for Jaws 3. And then Michael Caine did the same with this.
I hate the Razzies.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're kind of looking at themselves a little bit more now, aren't they? They're trying not to be. I think they used to be a lot crueler, and they're trying to kind of move away from that now. But it's a bit of a weird concept, isn't it? The Razzies, just telling people they're shit.
Well, the thing is, it's shit because they just focus on mainstream actors who are in films that are not up to the standard. They don't look at actual shit films that have kind of like DVD or kind of like home release or made for TV movies. They just look at theatrical films that have been, that it's just a spectacle to make small people feel big. That's what I think it is. I think it's just it's some dickheads who studied film at school, and now they're like, oh, I need to feel important. I'm going to make those really people that have been successful feel shit.
Well, that's going to get us some feedback from listeners. Thanks for that. No, I do agree. I've always thought the Razzies is a bit of a weird thing, but
yeah.
Bruce the Rubber Shark was nominated for a Razzie for Worst Actor for this movie.
Excellent.
It's the first animal nominated since Jaws 3D's dolphin twins, Cindy and Sandy. So there's another little link between those two movies. Despite kind of moving Jaws 3D out of the continuity of the series, there was a point at which they were considering using 3D elements for this movie as well. They were speaking to the people who provided the 3D cameras for Jaws 3, but ultimately they had to scrap that idea because those cameras don't work in hot weather. So they couldn't film in the Bahamas. In 1987, anyway, they couldn't guarantee that the cameras would work reliably. I guess probably they would have worked, but they had such a tight schedule that they couldn't take the risk of production being delayed by the cameras not working. Now, we spoke a few minutes ago about the alternative ending, which is, it's an absolute hot mess if you ask me. But anyway, there are two endings to this movie.
Yeah.
So the original ending is now regarded as the alternative ending, I believe.
That's correct, yes.
In which, and it's very similar. This is the thing that tickles me the most, is that they went back and did all these reshoots. And I watched the other ending and I was like, there's literally 10 seconds that are different between these two endings.
Yep.
And they went back and did loads of reshoots in my opinion.
They released the original ending in America.
Yes. So in America, the movie got released with what has become the alternative ending, in which the boat gets steered towards the shark and she impales the shark with the boat and blood. This is after the shark has eaten Jake. Jake is gone. She steers the boat towards the shark, impales the shark with the boat. Blood pours out of the shark's mouth. The weight of the shark dying breaks the nose off the boat. The boat falls apart. They all fall into the water. They get rescued. And then it cuts to the kind of the postscript scene, if you like, where they're getting on the plane. She's getting on the plane to go back to Amity. But test audiences it wasn't even test screenings. It was released, wasn't it? And the American audiences didn't like Jake dying, basically, I think was the issue. They didn't like that he died. So they shot this new ending in which the same thing happens. Jake gets eaten by the shark, or supposedly eaten by the shark. She steers the boat. She impales the boat, but at the point of impaling the shark with the boat, I guess manages to get the boat to hit the whatever it was that Jake had thrown into the shark's mouth, which we all thought was some sort of electromagnetic device that was just supposed to upset the shark's nervous system in much the same way as those little plug-in mouse and rat repellent things. I think it was supposed to be like a large-scale version of that. But apparently, if you hit one of those with a boat, it becomes an explosive.
Apparently.
So it seems. And so the shark blows up. And bits of shark go flying everywhere. And then they all still fall off the boat. And in their scramble to find each other after falling off the boat, up pops Jake. He's okay. It's weird. And that is the ending of the movie that we see. And then it cuts to that same scene where she's getting on the plane with Hoagie to go back home and she says goodbye to Mike and the family. Yeah. So the changes are subtle and yet massive. So a lot of it is the same, but it's, yeah. So in the original ending, the shark did not explode.
No.
It just got impaled and blood and it died. But Jake did die in the new ending. Jake randomly pops up. I mean, he definitely gets eaten by that shark, doesn't he? You see him fall into the shark's mouth.
Yeah, but he kind of like, he's in slow motion. He goes underneath the water, and while he's underneath the water, he's like half hanging in the shark's mouth as he's going down. So the idea is that Jake is, he's in the mouth and then the shark lets go of him. And then the
because the shark realizes that he's not a Brody. The shark's only interested in Brodies. That's why.
But you have the one from the banana boat.
I don't know. I'm just trying to make sense of this batshit movie.
Well, as a kid, when I used to watch this, I was convinced that he was swallowed whole by the shark. And as the shark exploded, Jake out pops. I was like, oh, that's how it works. You're a child.
Yeah, with the whale.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I thought.
Yeah.
But okay. I think they just changed it because they wanted something dramatic. So the whole piercing of the boat and spearing the fish with the ginormous boat isn't very dramatic like that. Once it happens and you see the shark hanging off the front of the boat and then breaking the boat apart, it's not very dramatic. An explosion's more dramatic. I prefer the spearing. And the thing is, when they came up with the idea of this, the producers wanted something different, and the director went to the producers and came up with a different idea of how to kill the shark, and his idea was to spear the shark or the boat, and that's what got him the job. So for them to suddenly get
this, and then they, changed it.
They changed it with this little model of a shark. And if you pause that movie, you can see this little plastic
You can
toy.
Almost see the kid's hand holding the shark toy, can't you?
It's so bad.
Yeah. So, there's some other bits of deleted scenes that, depending on whether you watched it on TV, because the thing with this movie, and I think that's where you say it has a bit of a cult following, that's because it was on TV a lot in America and in the UK. And depending on where you lived and which station you were watching on and how much time in the schedule, I guess, they had to fill, there were kind of different combinations of scenes that were left in and scenes that were cut. And I think the different endings were shown. I think the alternative ending is now what's used in the European releases and on the European.
It's the blowing
up. So in Europe, we have the one where he survives. And then some TV channels show the uncut American theatrical release where Jake dies and the shark is impaled. So the DVD releases have the explosion ending, which is the one that we both watched on digital release.
That's what comes up. That comes on the Blu-ray as well.
Yeah. But yeah, it's all a bit complicated. There's a book, actually, if anyone wants to kind of go on a real deep dive about this movie. I mean, you have, because you've read the book in its entirety. Yes. I've had a bit of a skim read through it. There's a book. You tell us about the book because you know more about it than I do.
So there's a book written by this guy called Paul Downey. Great guy. He wrote a book called The Shark Is Roaring. It's a play on the famous documentary, The Shark Is Still Working. I think the Jaws documentary is called. He's a great guy. And funny enough, I managed to catch up with him this week and we had a little chat. Do you want to listen to it?
Amazing. Of course I do. Yes. Play the tape, Michael.
I'm here with author Paul Downey, writer of The Shark Is Roaring, The Story of Jaws of Revenge. Welcome to Unloved Sequels, Paul.
Thank you. Long time listener, first time guest.
Oh, excellent. That's what I like to hear. So thank you for coming on the podcast. And oh my God, what an amazing book you have written. I was so blown away because I'm a massive Jaws of Revenge fan and it's quite hard to find another one. So when we discussed about doing a Jaws of Revenge episode, I knew that I had to have you on the podcast, and thank you for making yourself available that. What made you write a book about Jaws of Revenge?
I think it's kind of a long running one with me. I mean, I've always had a kind of probably call it a morbid fascination with it. I said this in the book, which makes it a bit cheesy, but I think it was around my 10th birthday or something like that. And I'm showing my age. So I had VHSs and Jaws had long been out of print, and my mum managed to bag me a copy of Jaws. I don't know how she got it through like a mail order, but she also got me Jaws the Revenge because they were the two Jaws films that were always kind of on television and the ones that I'd seen the most. But also it's kind of like, it's a bit like it's a formative experience in the sense that I always said that there was only two scenes in film when I was a child that really frightened me. And there was Quint's attack in Jaws, which I found very gruesome and quite disturbing, and the death of Sean Brody in Jaws the Revenge. And then years later, I was doing some writing for a magazine called the Scream Magazine. I think it's available like kind of worldwide. So it publishes out of the UK, but also does, you know, it is available, you know, overseas as well. And I managed to track down Mitchell Anderson, who played Sean Brody, for a feature for the, I think it was the 30th anniversary at the time. So yeah, it would have been 2017. And he owned like a Mexican restaurant somewhere in the US. Completely given up that, and this was kind of his career now. He was living with his partner. I think that him and his partner kind of co-owned this Mexican place, and they, like, I got in touch with him, and he was so forthcoming with answers, and I kind of, you know, and it was a great article. It was the front cover as well, which I'd never really had for a horror magazine, so I was buzzing on that. And when I was a few years had kind of passed, and I was doing a co-project with an author called Dave Hastings, and we wrote about Black Christmas. So we wrote about 1974 Black Christmas, 2006 Black Christmas, and the 2019 version. And during that period when we were doing the research, I had a bit of downtime because I'd put my work in there up front. So Dave was kind of filling in the blanks, and I kind of had the itch to write again. And I was like, what can I write about that I do know about? And I was like, I do know about Jaws the Revenge. But what I realized is that there was a story there that I hadn't really seen told before, in the sense that production was quite messy. And for me, from writing the Black Christmas book, the parts that weirdly, that I kind of enjoyed writing about the most was the messy productions of 2006 and 2019. Jaws being this massive franchise. I mean, people probably a bit younger than I am probably don't realise how massive that franchise was. Even around the time of like the mid-90s when it had kind of gone away, it was still this huge franchise and a big deal. But then from reading about the production and the way it was filmed and everything else, like, this could have legs. So I started reaching out to some parts of the crew who were still alive. And I got a couple of interviews under my belt. And I kind of started collating information. So I managed to get a copy of the novelization. I got a press kit that someone from America was kind enough to sell me, and just kind of piecing together what I thought this kind of story was. And then, you know, almost like from the inception of it right through to completion, and obviously the kind of legacy of it whilst trying to keep a straight face. And I just started to collate this collection. And I also, through some contacts, managed to get some different versions of the film. So there's technically probably three or four versions out there of the film. Slight deviations, obviously. The ending is obviously the most problematic of all the versions. Let's face it. But there's a version on AMC that was screened in the, I think it probably was in the early 90s, and it's kind of got some scenes in there that aren't in the finished film. There's a cut on the BBC that's in the wrong ratio, so you can see all the shark's mechanics. Well, and then
that's the one I grew up with, was the BBC one, and I suppose you grew up as well, being both brought up in the UK. That's what I was inflicted with a lot as a childhood, was the BBC cut, where they changed the ratio of the screen so you can see the mechanical shark bits underneath, but still haunt me.
Yeah, the thing is, though, as a child, and probably going into my teen years and beyond, for ages, I never really picked up on it until somebody really pointed it out. I was like, oh yeah, you can really see it. You know, never kind of thought anything of it. And it's like, oh, it's really obvious, isn't it? It really is. And it's like, oh, okay. Yeah. So from collating all this information, it was kind of a case of just kind of mapping it all out. And then just the writing process was actually really fluid, in the sense that I could just, because I knew this film, I felt like, I may not know it inside out, but I knew it as well as I knew any film. Yeah. And I could just write about it. And then obviously from speaking to the cast and crew and people like that, they were able to almost like kind of fill in the blanks. And then it was a really fun experience, just kind of just putting it all together. And we both can probably acknowledge that it's not a perfect film, but it does have its certain charms.
Yeah, well, for me, it's just a movie that reminds me of my childhood. And like, I just think it's a shame that people don't like it for what it is. You just got to go in there and go, it's a plastic shark with Michael Caine and a plane. That's all you need to think about with this film.
Yeah, and the thing is, there's so much nuance in terms of the circumstances. Yeah. Because obviously you look at the cast, and the cast is
stellar
in terms of what they got. I mean, obviously going back to kind of the experience, obviously the way I kind of looked at it for years, we're talking in pre-internet days, is all I knew for quite a long time, especially in the UK because they were so hard to get hold of, was Jaws and Jaws the Revenge. And then kind of Jaws 2 was my next experience, and then eventually Jaws 3 was kind of the last one I saw. So it was always kind of, because we had the continuity of having Lorraine Gary in both of them. I know she's in Jaws 2 as well, but the fact that she'd kind of come back and become like the front, you know, the star essentially, was this kind of continuity that my child brain could kind of understand. But yeah, I mean, obviously you look at it, I mean, Mario Von Peebles is on the way up. Someone like Lynn Whitfield goes on and has a great career. You know, especially within television, you know, Lance Guest, he basically was given the role, you know, and then you've got Michael Caine, who's in this really weird paycheck period of his career. And look at Michael Caine's 80s output and tell me it's like a roller coaster.
But everybody's so good in it. Like, it's much more of a character-based film. What was it like interviewing the cast?
The cast was really interesting, in the sense that obviously with Mitchell, he kind of came first, in the sense that, but, and he was so forthcoming with information, even after we'd kind of done the interview. And I realized that this had legs and I wanted to do the book. I just reached out to him again. I said, do you mind if I ask you some more questions? Like, yeah, just go ahead. It's fine. You know, weirdly, Mitchell had kind of returned to acting very briefly at that stage. So I think he was doing a project with one of his friends. I think Kevin Spiritas was in Friday the 13th Part 7 for the slasher fans of who listen. So they're good friends. So they did a limited series together, I think, shortly after, about a year after we spoke. So I think they did that in 2018. Just some of the crew. The difficult part was some of the people that I would have loved to have spoken to are no longer with us. People like Joseph Sargent, who to me in like the early 90s, I thought Joe Sargent, no disrespect, was this really huge director, because he directed the Jaws film.
Ditto.
And then I realized he was kind of like, he's got Taken of Pelham 1, 2, 3, and then his career kind of it doesn't nosedive, but he kind of finds his kind of level, essentially, because a couple of years back I watched a film of his. It was an anthology film called it's called Nightmares or Nightmare. Bloody dreadful. It's awful. It makes George the Revenge look great, even better. But then the double act for me that kind of really sealed the deal was spending an hour on Skype to Lance Guest, and he was an absolute delight. He was so forthcoming with information. He knows what he he's part of.
Yeah.
And when he goes to conventions, anyone will probably tell you who's been to a convention that Lance Guest has been at, is he will have three films across his banner. He will have Jaws the Revenge, he will have The Last Starfighter, and he will have Halloween 2. Because they are the films that he is known for, because they're genre films, and yeah, people know Jaws the Revenge, you know, whether they like it or they loathe it, they know it's, you know, it's part of history, essentially.
Mm.
And obviously the kind of the icing on the cake for me, which was the last interview I was able to do, was Lorraine Gary, who took a lot of tracking down, because she hadn't really... She'd kind of disappeared from public life, barring a little bit of social media.
Yeah.
And was in her advanced years. So I didn't know what I was going to get back from her. But what I got back from her, I can safely say she answered everything that I asked her about it. In terms of the context of it, so Lorraine was married to the president of Universal, Sid Sheinberg.
Yeah.
And Sid Sheinberg passed away a couple of years back. I think it might have been just before the pandemic. So obviously it could have been a difficult subject to talk about, because Sid was very involved with Jaws the Revenge. Some may say maybe too involved or whatever, but he was involved. It was his passion project. He wanted Lorraine to be his Ripley, essentially. Yeah. which is fascinating when you think it, when you kind of, you would never see that comparison between Aliens, you know, the science fiction juggernaut classic, and Jaws the Revenge. But you've got to take into context the ripple effect of that film in 1986. And then people are like, it's like anything, isn't it? You've got to kind of almost create your own with what you have. And what Sid had is he had Jaws, and, you know, they wanted to revive it. They wanted, you know, they wanted Roy Scheider back. They may have wanted others back, but so Lorraine was the kind of, was always going to be this focal point of it, which... It's very interesting, especially, you know, because we can dive deeper into things like the representation of women, you know, and how she is portrayed on screen, you know,
yeah,
and the fact that obviously she hadn't acted in best part of 10 years, you know, and kind of came into this really cold. And she's, and from talking to her, the information that she gave,
she was great.
Yeah, she was really forthcoming and very genuine at the same time. And she didn't really pull her punches, which I quite liked, because it's very easy to speak to someone, especially for a film that's fairly new. You almost get the publicity reel, you know, almost get the lines they're meant to say. Whereas so much time has passed with this film that people can speak quite openly about it, about the things that went right, the things that went wrong. It was really fascinating to hear it basically from the horse's mouth.
The interviews that I found absolutely fascinating, because when I picked up the book and I was like, he couldn't have got Lorraine for an interview, there's no way. And then suddenly I was like, oh my God, he did, that's amazing.
Yeah, it was really interesting. And I can say this now because the book's released and everything, but when I put out on social media, because I knew what kind of reaction it would get amongst there, because the Facebook page has been fantastic. There's a real fervor and like for this kind of movie on the Facebook page. And when I said to them that I got Lorraine Gary, I got an email out of the blue from a magazine, and they basically offered me a lot of money to put the interview in the magazine before it went in the book. And I told them no. I said, you know, this is something that to me as a fan of the film was such a big deal, because I was like, I would never have expected in a million years, you know, and I know it's, you know, to some people it's this B movie and it's not a good movie, but to me it was really special to kind of speak to somebody who I'd kind of seen on screen. And you know, I really kind of responded to that performance, because I think I've said it in a couple of times in the book. I think there is some parts of it obviously are perfect, but I think there is a real desire to do something around the idea of trauma You know, not in a kind of Laurie Strode Halloween 2018 kind of way, but the way that people deal with it. And I think anyone who's kind of lost people close to them knows that it's a real roller coaster of emotions. Like, you can be happy one day, you can be sad the next, you can be, you know, wanting to hunt down a shark the next. I don't know, but there is something in that. And especially them early scenes, I find them, especially as you know, as you get a bit older, you kind of feel it a bit more, you know, when you're, you know, at my age, you know, when you're getting close to 40, you may start to lose parents. And you wonder how people kind of, the coping mechanisms behind it. And I think parts of the film like that do work, but then there are other parts that are just, you know, you can kind of just enjoy for the comic value of them now.
What's your opinion on the way they try to erase Jaws 3 within the franchise? Because they kind of like don't reference it at all. How do you feel? Why do you think as a business they decided to completely eradicate Jaws 3D?
I think it's because, I think basically the box office failure does have a lot to say in terms of, you know, kind of the erasure of it. I think there was a real desire, certainly from the off, to kind of, because the interesting part about it is when they start filming, it's not Jaws the Revenge, it's not Jaws 4, it's Jaws 87, which effectively is what we are getting now in the Hollywood cycle with our Scream 2022s, our Halloween 2018s, whatever's, they're just using the same title and they're just changing the year and basically trying to rehash. And the thing is with Jaws the Revenge, what you have is you do have these beats that it does hit. So, that, you know, there's an opening kill scene, a scene out at sea on a boat, you know, where someone is effectively hunting the shark. You know, there is an attack on a beach, you know, essentially where, you know, the Alex Kittner death is replaced by the banana boat attack. So it hits these little bits of riffs and, you know, and the characters themselves. So obviously you could possibly say that, you know, Michael is his father, Jake is almost a hybrid of Quint and Hooper from Jaws, and, you know, and Lorraine is Lorraine, you know, as Alan. You've got these in the generational element, the fact that they repeat that scene at the dinner table with Michael and Thea at the table is not a coincidence. They really want you to kind of get the nostalgia of 75 and try to hit that audience again. But in terms of the way I think it is, it's basically because Jaws 83 was, in terms of the 3D one, obviously it was going to be a comedy, it was going to be this, it was going to be that. They wanted to possibly, they possibly thought it was too comical, they wanted to be more straight-edged.
Yeah.
In all the publicity that I read about, they always talked about this going back to basics, which is sequel spiel that you can look in the horror genre for the past 40, 50 years, and when things start to go awry, as in they don't make the money, they project or what they want to, they say, we're bringing it back to the original because that's what will bring in the audience, the established audience. And yeah, and I think there's a desire with that. Obviously, you know, the poster artwork is, you know, is fairly similar. They're trying to riff on it. You know, personally, the score, even though it's not John Williams, is the best score since 75, and I'll die on that hill because
it's amazing.
I genuinely think it's a great score. You know, it's fantastic. You know, it's orchestral. It rises at the right times. You know, it hits them kind of beats, and it's also got a little bit of nuance to it. You know, it's great. So yeah, I think in terms of kind of moving away from it, it is that literal. It's almost like it's basically the requel of the Jaws series, if you want to say.
Yeah, one of the things I want to talk to you about, I found it very eye opening that you decided to write a chapter on the actress that played Thea Brody. How was it to do that kind of research away from the research for the movie and actually take it a true life crime aspect into that chapter?
It wasn't nice. It was really horrible. And to be honest, till about probably 10 years ago, I didn't know what happened to the actress, Judith Barzee. But I always thought to myself, because this was one of her last film roles, so she kind of did this, she did Land Before. I think her last technical role, I think, was All Dogs Go to Heaven as a voice role. And she also was a voice in The Land Before Time, which was a favourite of mine when I was a child. But I never joined the dots in terms of it being the same voice. Yeah, it did. It turned into like this kind of true crime kind of expose in the way. And even some of the research was really weird because there was this mini series, like a web series in 2020, and it came out and it was these people who'd lived in the house where she had been, her and her mother had been killed. And they were saying that they were haunted by the spirits. And I was like, this is, you know, it was bordering on camp. It's so bizarre. I mean, you can find it online. It's only like a 20-minute segment, but they were trying to do these spells to kind of get rid of the spirits because it was like an unwelcome spirit. And I was like, but they were playing it really straight. And I was like, are they for real? But in terms of the research, what I found is because I was doing a lot of research with like historical newspapers and that, the case itself, it's a big warning sign in terms of, you know, the abuse of children and obviously recognizing the red flags and that, and people potentially asking for help and not getting it, and the worst case scenario happens. And it was, you know, some of the details of it, you know, and everything is pretty much in the book in terms of what I found. It was something
that was really interesting.
It was really interesting. Well, it is the fact that it's a child, a mother and a child, obviously, the weird connection in terms of bringing it back to George the Revengers, that one of the pallbearers was Lance Guest's funeral, and it's heartbreaking.
It's very touching.
Things that I was very conscious of, especially when talking to Lance, was not to bring that up. I went out of my way not to say anything because it's a lot, you know, a long time has passed and potentially it could bring up some very sad memories and taint his kind of enthusiasm for the film because of, you know, the aftermath of, you know, someone who was obviously very mentally ill. But yeah, I mean, it's one of them. It's a lot of happy-go-lucky in the book, and we talk to people about their experience, and then some people are, you know, forthcoming, some aren't. But then you have that, but it's part of the film's legacy. I would feel very, I think we would be missing, not so much missing a trick because that sounds exploitative, but I think it's an important part of the story to tell.
No, I agree. So in an imaginary world, if the head of Universal came to you today and said, Paul, we're going to remake Jaws of Revenge, what would you change and what would you keep in this movie?
I wouldn't show the wires, first of all.
I think it'd be CGI now. Would be a real shame, though. Because that's the thing, though. It's another question. Jurassic Park films, when they did Jurassic World, everybody complained that they weren't enough animatronics. So the later ones they made, they went back to the old technique of doing CGI and animatronic, and they'd probably have to, if they did a Jaws film today, they'd probably do that. They'd probably have to do both.
Yeah, well, that's the sad part is that because if we're saying what we'd keep, so I keep the opening attack because I think it's absolutely horrifying. It's probably the most violent attack in the entire series for me. I mean, Quint's death is pretty harrowing. Alex Kittner, it's brutal, but it's over really quickly. Sean's death kind of goes across probably about 90 seconds, maybe 2 minutes, and it's horrible, you know. Yeah. The screaming out, no one can hear him, and the Christmas carols are playing over him. It's horrifying, and the fact that, you know, you kind of, you find the barge the next day and the funeral and that, and then them first few minutes are harrowing, you know, because they're a real raw portrayal of what this kind of thing can do to someone. We never usually see too much aftermath, essentially, whereas here we do because it's so personal, as in this time it's personal, but... I keep the banana boat attack. I think that's a good sequence. I'd probably tweak things a bit in terms of I do like the shipwreck chase. I think there's some good things in there, and what it does have is it has for me one of the scariest shots of the sequel, in that when he's in the shipwreck, the shark goes over his head and literally almost blocks out the sun.
Yeah,
it's horrifying because if you are trapped down there and you see something of that size that it clearly wants to eat you, you must be thinking, well, I'm a goner, you know, I'm sharky. And the most obvious thing I'd probably change is the ending. You know, there's quite transparent in the book and saying that the ending goes off the rails big style. Them last 15 or so minutes are chaos because they don't really know what to do with it.
Are you a blowing up stabbing fan, or are you blood gushing from the mouth fan?
The ending I always knew was the blown up, and I never really kind of understood how. I always remember because my dad was a massive Jaws fan, not Jaws the Revenge fan, but he always used to try to explain to me that sharks couldn't roar, and I never believed him. I just thought, yeah, whatever, you know, come on, of course they do.
But if you're going to believe a shark can swim the length of New England to the Bahamas in the same time as a flight, you have to realistically believe that a shark can roar. So I'm a bit like, well, if that happened, why can't a shark roar? It's a mutated shark. As a kid, I was always like, whatever, never bothered me. It never really offended me that much.
Yeah. No, and maybe that's it. Maybe just place that kind of almost that that child sensibility of just suspend your disbelief and go in. Because as I always say to anyone who tries to challenge me on Jaws the Revenge, I say, say what you want about it, but it's never boring. You know, it's outrageous. It's off the wall, but it's never boring.
Well, thanks for coming on today, Paul. How can people get in contact with you, and where can people find your book?
Yeah, so I think the best way to get in touch with me, so Facebook, you can find, if you search Jaws Revenge Book, that's the official Facebook page. Try and update it, you know, sporadically with news, obviously, you know, about the book. Sometimes we host competitions as well. Instagram is at BloodyFlixUK, and Twitter is at BloodyFlix. So that's my website as well. So always kind of viewing like horror and genre stuff, covering some film festivals at the moment. And yeah, the book is available. It's on Amazon, so you can get the paperback version and the hardback version on there. Or you can go to the Bear Manor Media website. So they've got a hardback version, a paperback version. But you can also get the ebook. Yeah, and enjoy. And if you like it, please leave us a review on it. On Amazon, it helps to spread the word. People who may want to check out this wacky film.
It's a great book, and it's such a nice to speak to somebody who has a love for this for a movie that sits at 0% on Rotten Tomatoes and a lot of people hate. And I'm glad I've spoken to you today. But before we go, a question we like to ask all our guests. What is one of your favourite unloved sequels?
It's got to be Jason X from the Friday the 13th franchise.
I love Jason's movies. I love Jason X, Uber Jason.
Yes, Uber Jason.
Paul, thank you for coming on today. I really appreciate it. And good luck with the book. And I can't wait to see what you do next.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
That was brilliant, Michael. He sounds like a really interesting guy. And actually, now that I've heard that conversation between the two of you, I'm going to go back and have a proper read through the book, because the bits that I kind of skim read, because I knew we were going to be doing this podcast, it was very interesting, but it sounds like I've missed out on quite a lot. So I'm going to go back and have another read. So, yeah, thanks for doing that interview for us, Michael. And thank you, Paul, for giving us your time.
Yeah, it was such a great chat. And it's, as a fan of the movie, to be able to sit down with Paul and have that conversation, it was really nice, because it's very rare that you come across someone who likes this movie as much as I do.
It's so, a long time since I've heard you sound quite as excited as you are in that clip.
Yeah, no, he's... he's a really nice guy. And guys, if you want to get a chance to read the book, download it. It's available on Kindle. You can get it on Amazon. Matter of fact, we will put all the links to buy it on Kindle and Amazon on our socials when this episode comes out.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Okay. So having established that you really like this movie, Michael, in the nicest possible way, why?
Well, I always grew up with Jaws as one of my favourite movies. So I like being in that universe. I like the aspects of that family and the shark. What this brings to the table that Jaws 3D didn't bring to the table is I like the character development between these. I always felt that Jaws 1 and 2, as much as it was about a shark, it was also about about a family and about their characters and the way that the impact of that shark had on the island. And I felt this one brings that back to the table. I believe that you've got character development, you've got a lot going on in this movie. It's a very short running movie. It's 90 minutes, so for like...
Yes, I always like a short movie.
Yeah, so to be able to kind of like get that story wrapped up, I think the issues with this film is that it had a 9-month shooting schedule from start of production to post-production. It was rushed, but I don't think the cast does anything. I like seeing this cast back together. I really like the Ellen and Hoagie romance. I think it's really nice.
Yes, to have a romance agree. Between them.
And I think it's difficult because in Jaws the novel, the original novel, Ellen has an affair with Matt Hooper. So there is a massive Matt
Hooper.
And Matt Hooper dies. He gets eaten by the shark in the original book.
Of course he does. If he's an adulterer, this is horror movie 101. Yeah. If you're an adulterer, you have to die.
Yeah, so he dies. And Chief Brody is really happy that he got eaten by a shark because he was fucking his wife.
Yeah, okay. I'll give him a pass on that.
So
harsh but fair.
And do you know what? I when I was watching this the other day, it never really dawned on me, but I really thought, I wonder if they wanted Hoagie to be Matt Hooper. And then to kindle that romance that was happened very famously in the book, and having instead of having, you know, Matt Hooper being on the boat and being a marine biologist with Mike, and then Ellen rekindles that love affair that was originally erased from the original movie. It's the same age period. I really like Michael Caine in this. There's something about Michael Caine talking about a big fish when you're driving a big plane. Or out. All right, governor, you get away.
He's
from
really
the
hard
fish.
To not like, though, in anything. I'm trying to think of anything I've seen with him in that I've not enjoyed him in.
No, and he's and the one thing is, he's such a nice guy in real life. When I worked in Harrods, he used to come in. He lived around the corner from Harrods.
Have you got a tenuous connection to the movie?
I do. So I used to manage the book department in Harrods, and he used to come in weekly to pick up his newspaper and magazines, and he used to sit and talk to me about movies for such a long time.
As if Harrods is Michael Caine's newspaper shop.
It is. I don't know if he still goes in there, but he used to go in there all the time. But one fun example with this was, one time I was talking to Michael Caine, and then I got called over to the customer service area to help another VIP customer, and it was Christian Bale. And I walked him back over to book department. I said, I think you two know each other. And I got to spend an hour with Michael Caine and Christian Bale. And as a Batman fan, have I never told you the story?
Well, if you did, I wasn't sober or wasn't listening.
I sat
That's
there.
That's an amazing story.
And literally, they sat there. But the thing is, in my mind, because I'm such a big Batman fan, I kept going, Batman, Alfred, Batman, Alfred. he's such a nice guy in real life. But yeah, there's nothing in this film I don't like. I appreciate the shark look.
Really?
Shit. Yeah.
There's nothing you don't like.
Well, I don't like the ending with the blowing up. I do know the original ending of the spear hitting the shark and the shark ripping off the front of the boat. I'm happy with that. I don't know why they changed it. I didn't really care if Jake survived or not. I didn't really have that much of a connection with him, because I thought he was a bit of a dick half the film when he kept having a go at Michael. He had no compassion that his brother just died. He would shout at him and go,
I know.
Oh, sorry, man, about your brother dying.
Into him. Oh, yeah, your brother just died like 3 days ago. Sorry about that. Anyway. Yeah.
You pissed off back to my auntie to see your mum. Oh, because your brother died.
Yeah.
I was just like, I really like the character development. I really like the people playing the parts. I don't have an issue with this. The sharks always look plastic to me. And because I grew up watching 1, 2, 3, and 4 constantly, they still look all plastic to me. The Bahamas water is not forgiving for a plastic shark. The advantage that Jaws 1 and 2 had is that the water around Martha's Vineyard is dark and grim, and very much it's easier to hide faults. Like, the issue with this movie is that the fact of that they filmed the shark so openly, but I think they were going for the fact of the whole Freddy Krueger. Now that we know what Freddy looks like, he's no longer scary, so we just want to show Freddy Krueger. Because towards the end of the Nightmare on Elm Street films, where in the original couple of movies, he was hiding in the shadows.
Yeah.
Now he was in the last couple of movies, in 4, 5, and 6, whatever, they just laid him bare because that's what they thought the audience wanted. And I feel like with the director of this, he felt like the audience just wanted to see the shark. And, you know,
and to be fair, I would have been happy seeing, I mean, I was happy to see the shark. I just would have preferred to see a shark that looked a bit better.
But
I think,
you know,
if we're going to see that much shark, the shark needs to be good.
Yeah. Yeah,
To be fair, give the movie its dues. This is the first time I've seen this movie.
Yeah.
In 2023, as an adult. Mm-hmm. You first saw this movie, and I'm assuming a lot of the other people who are fond of this movie have seen it for the first time as children, but also in a world where that's what cinematic effects were. You know, things have progressed so much in the 35 years? Near enough since this movie came out. So expectations are higher. So I think the fact that I'm watching this for the first time, having, you know, spent the last few weekends watching contemporary movies with contemporary effects, and then I go and watch this and I'm like, meh, this is a bit shit. And I'm an adult and I've got that much more critical eye on it. Whereas, you know, you watched it as a child, you're far less critical at that age. And that wasn't as crap an effect then as it seems now, I suppose.
There is hardly anything in this film I dislike. Yes, I think the shark looks plastic, but I think the shot looked plastic in 2, 3 and 4. There's a scene in 2 where he slams into the side of a boat and his whole fush mushes up. I just think to this point of, this film wasn't as successful. By the time they had made this movie, they had jumped the shark. People were bored of the franchise. It wasn't going anywhere. Like, Jaws, the actual hardcore fans of Jaws were so niche by then, they were the only ones watching the movies.
Yeah.
And then 2 years later, you have Back to the Future Part 2 come out, when it goes, they have this famous scene where the hologram shark comes out of cinema and it says Jaws 19.
Jaws 19.
We were on part 4 by then. There was other franchises with 6 or 7 episodes by then. Mm. It got this reputation in Hollywood of flogging a dead horse or the dead shark. And I think that's the reputation it's held on to. And I think if a lot of people sit down and watch this movie, you can't criticize the acting in this. You can't criticize some of the cinematography, like the underwater stuff, when the shark's not in it, is shot really well. Like some of the coral stuff, and some of the underwater sea life and stuff. Some of it's beautiful. If I could change anything in this movie, I would probably change the last 15 minutes of it. I would want Lorraine Gary to go hardcore as hell and maybe like start spearing the shark and stuff.
Well, yeah. So this was my thing. So I agree actually with a lot of what you just said of things that you like in this movie. I love that we've got an older female front and centre in this movie. In 1987, that's brilliant. And I love that we've got this sort of middle-aged romance subplot going on. And I like that even Michael Caine commented at the time that it was unusual for him to be playing a romance story with an actor the same age as him.
Yes.
So I love that. Sadly, this is not something that we continue to see from Hollywood. I wish that we did see that more. But I love that we've got an age-appropriate relationship involving older people. Mm. I think the ending... I thought the point at which, after the banana boat scene, and you see the kind of cogs ticking in Ellen's mind, and she goes off and takes the boat, and I thought that this was her going all fucking Laurie Strode, and she was gonna hunt that fucking shark down and end it. So then when it got to the point where you realized that actually what she was going to do was just give herself to the shark, I was really disappointed in that.
Yes,
because I thought she was properly gonna go and Jamie Lee Curtis the shit out at the end of the movie. And then she did that about face at the end, and she thought, no, I'm gonna take the shark on, I'm gonna do it. But it was just, by then it was just all a bit meh. And I think if she'd just gone to do that in the first place and not had that moment of standing at the front of the boat waiting for the shark to take her, I would have enjoyed the ending a lot more, because I felt like she'd lost that little moment of empowerment. She'd been very empowered through a lot of the movie, and it just kind of, that little moment undermined the strength that she had as a character. I quite strongly don't like Jake surviving. Not because of Jake particularly. I just think to have not killed Hoagie and then not killed Jake in the space of 5-10 minutes, you've basically played the same cheap trick on us twice. And I was like, you can't, you know, I was genuinely surprised when Hoagie survived, as I think we were all supposed to be. And then I was, when Jake got killed, I was sad, and I put in my notes, you know, that's harsh that Jake got killed. But when he came back, that was worse. I was just like, why would you do that? We didn't need him to survive.
No, I agree. But a lot of people have issues with this film towards the end, where when she's heading towards the shark and they add those flashback scenes in from Jaws.
Flashbacks. Let's talk about flash. I mean, that flashbacks is not the right word for this, because flashbacks heavily suggests that this is a character remembering things that they've seen before. None of those clips are from her point of view.
No. I think that, and that's the thing, is people look at them as flashbacks, and a lot of critics and other Jaws fans look at them as flashbacks. For me, though we know they're the correct way what happened, because we witnessed them in the movie, in my mind, I think that's how she imagined them.
Well, I saw a couple of things, and I can't remember, I can't quite work out how much of this is what I've read when I was doing my deep dive and how much of it is me joining the dots and maybe being a bit bonkers. So apologies if I'm saying something that seems so completely left field that it can't possibly be true. But all of those clips are from the shark's point of view.
Yes.
And so the theory that I think I've read it, I don't think I've come up with it all by myself, was that linking back to this whole witch doctor voodoo thing and the possibility that there is some kind of telepathic connection between Ellen Brody and the shark, that there is some sort of something connecting, linking the two of them together. And actually what she's seeing in those moments is the shark's flashbacks.
Yeah.
So if you want to subscribe to that view of things, that makes perfect sense. But equally what you say, that it, you know, it's just her having those moments of, this happened to my son. We can't see a character's thoughts.
Yes.
They have to show us. There has to be a clip of something.
I agree.
So it doesn't make sense as flashbacks. So they're not.
But they're not flashback. The only flashback in the whole film that she has is when Tia and Michael are at the table, and they're redoing what Michael did with his dad. And
they do that little scene that's the homage. Yeah, I mean, there's quite a lot of that in this film. There's a lot of little moments that are nods to earlier scenes in the franchise, and that was a really lovely one. Actually, that was very sweet. That kind of mirroring.
I think it also makes it quite sweet when you watch it back now, because you know that the actress who played Tia was obviously killed by her father. And having that one scene in there where she has a strong relationship with her father and that wasn't her real life, I find that quite difficult to process quite a lot. But she didn't have that. She obviously...
Yes, I'm quite glad I didn't find that out about her until after I'd seen the movie.
Yeah. No, I clearly
did have a really good relationship with him as Lance, well, with Lance. Yeah.
Lance
I've
Guest.
Forgotten his surname. Yes, Lance Guest. Because he was one of her pallbearers, wasn't he?
Yeah.
It's nice that they had that kind of close relationship. Yeah, I think I'm quite torn on this movie. I think the shark, or the way the shark is used, lets the movie down. I agree with you that it's good. I like that we're seeing more of the family. I think I would have liked to have seen more Amity.
Yeah, I agree. In the book, you're with Amity for a big chunk. Like, there's a whole bit where after Sean is killed, when I want to say Tiffany or Tina.
Yeah, Tiffany, his fiancée. I felt really bad for her. They were like, okay, he's dead. You're not in the story anymore. Hang on a minute. She was going to marry her son. Surely, like, they're still family.
Yeah,
surely.
But then she...
Like, would you not take her, like, come to the Bahamas with me? I'm going to the Bahamas to get away from it, or come and spend some time.
No.
Or I don't know, maybe not. No,
especially when you're going to go grieve with your son and you want your mind off it. Taking the person who's been killed, you're not going to get out of
it. I felt bad for her that she was cut off out of the family quick smart once he was dead. That seemed harsh to me.
Like, for me, there's so many iconic scenes in this movie as well. Like, what have gone down in Jaws history, like the banana boat scene, very iconic, great scene. I like the opening death with Sean. I think that's quite terrifying, the way he's
that's gruesome.
Sunken ship scene's pretty cool. And the nightmare scene where she's having the nightmare and she's swimming in the ocean and the shark attacks her. The scenes in this movie, they are collectively really, really good. They just should have shown less shark. And I think when they were making the shark, I don't think they came in to make a bad shark. When they thought they were making a more of a realistic shark. And there is aspects of the shark in Jaws Revenge that are more realistic than the shark in Jaws, because they went to the effort of doing like protruding gums and the fact that he could gnaw on stuff and his face actually moved. What they didn't really do very much in the original couple of movies, he just opened and shut his mouth.
Yeah.
But they felt so, because they thought they had this amazing looking shark, they just overexposed him.
Yeah.
Like, even at the end where he's roaring, and I know people get annoyed that he roars. But when he's sticking out that roar and roar, the shark looks great when he sticks his head out and he roars. They just didn't make
I mean, aside from the fact that sharks can't roar, sharks can't get themselves out of the water in quite that way. Like, this is the thing. For all that you said, there are elements that are more realistic and that are more accurate, and that's great. And we've got a lot more shark going on in this movie. But what we see is so implausible. There's a lot of suspension of disbelief required for basically anything to do with the shark in this movie. And I think if you can get past that, there's a lot to enjoy.
Yeah.
But it's asking a huge amount of the audience
There is some
to kind of go on that ride and to just go, okay, I'm going to ignore the fact that most of this movie could not happen.
Especially when he jumps and he just lowers into the water gently instead of splashing. That annoys me. Because you're kind of like, he jumps out the water, suddenly he's just lowered and they go back to him. But you don't need to show him. You can see him jumping out the water. You don't need to see. We know he's going back in the water. There were some direction choices that were just like, no, just don't show us that. In our mind, we know the shark's back in the water.
Yeah.
We don't need to see him being lowered gently into the water because sharks would fall with quite a thump if they jump when they jump out of the water. So I always think that's really weird. I do think this short film gets a harder rap than it deserves. And I don't blame the director. I don't blame the cast. I don't blame the scriptwriter. I blame Universal Studios for rushing this shoot and wanting something to go out.
Yeah. I mean, that's inexperienced director and writer. They're not inexperienced, but they've not got much experience of this level of movie making.
But none of them did. So to push them into
that tight schedule, I think led them to make mistakes.
Yeah. Well, I think they were just hoping they would put it out of the bag, like, because the director of Jaws 1, 2, and 3 were all unknown directors.
Mm.
They just followed that trope of getting cheap. You know, like, can you imagine if Spielberg made a Jaws movie today? It would be so pristine and tight, and the camera angles and the graphics and the special effects would be absolutely amazing. But these films have always been treated really, they've always been money bags.
This is my thing, is that I'm trying to work out where 22, whatever it was, million dollars went on this movie, other than taking everyone to the Bahamas.
Because you would have to...
if we're talking about, okay, so we don't know what everyone got paid, but we know Michael Caine got 1.5 million. He will have been the highest paid performer
in this movie.
And it's not a huge cast. I mean, there's a lot of extras, but in terms of cast that would have been paid significant money, it's not a huge cast. So that won't have cost a huge amount. The production team, as you say, they were not established, well-known movie crew, so they wouldn't have got paid a huge amount. They clearly didn't spend a huge amount of money on the shark. No. I mean, they probably did spend a huge amount of money, but in the scheme of things, I just feel like, where is that $22 million? Because I can't see it on the screen, is my issue.
Well, I kind of like have an idea. So that shark was built in probably Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get a 25-foot, 30-foot shark with a crane to the Bahamas? You would have to ship it.
Mm.
You'd have to hire a massive crater ship. It would have been freaking expensive.
Yeah.
You know?
But then that's the issue, isn't it? The money that was spent in the wrong places. They should have found a way of not needing to do... If that's the budget they had, they should have gone, okay, well, we can't do this because look how much the budget we're going to spend on shipping. And there is no shipping. You can't see shipping in the movie.
No, but also the planes, they sank two of those planes. Actually, if you go to
that
would
have cost a few quid, to be fair.
If you go to the Bahamas, plane is still on the bottom of the ocean. You can go there. They've left it there. You can dive there.
Wow.
But apparently, I don't know if it's a mythology or whatever, but the ship in he travels through with the shark, that's an actual ship that's also sunk in the Bahamas, but it was sunk by a James Bond film and it was used in one of the Roger Moore movies.
Yeah, they filmed quite a lot of James Bonds over in that same bit, didn't they?
Yeah.
I saw quite a popular location for the 70s
and
80s.
Well, that beach is actually horrible in real life. It's full of litter and crap, and every time they filmed it, it's not popular with
these days.
Yeah, but this was back then, and the reason why they like to film there is because it's not popular with the public, because it's like a dump. So the crew have to come in and they come in and they clean
so then they do a big cleanup, and then they've got a nice clean beach that people aren't going to be getting in the way.
Yep.
Yeah. Interesting.
So before we move on to actually scoring this movie, let's talk about the score of the movie. Did you see what I did there? I do.
Oh, well done, you. Yeah.
I know. I felt proud about that for a second. Simple things. So the composer of this and the writer of the score was Michael Small.
Yes. And
I think he did a fantastic job.
Yes.
He did lots of music. I don't think he got the acclaim that he ever deserved. He did music for Deptford Wife, the 1975 original thriller, not the comedy, black comedy.
No, not the new one.
Not the black comedy with Nicole Kidman and Bette Midler. And he also did The Marathon Man with Dustin Hoffman and Roy Scheider in, who was in the first two Jaws. So it's like goes full circle. So that's kind of nice. Yeah. The soundtrack was announced that it was going to get a tape release at the time.
CD,
a tape release at the time. But due to the terrible box office performance of the movie, it immediately got cancelled.
Yeah.
So
you can't get the soundtrack now, can you, to listen?
No, you can. You can get it. So there was two releases of it. There was a promo release of it, what was the right top like eight tracks of it, that was released just for promotional use in 2000. It must have gone in line with a DVD or a Blu-ray release of Jaws of Revenge. That's really expensive online now because it's limited release. And then later on, there was also another CD release of it, what was played with all the tracks released from everything he recorded for the film. But that currently sits at like $259 on Amazon. So,
right.
And you can buy it on, you can buy like bootleg copies of it and stuff. But I'm like, you can listen to it on YouTube too if you want to. Somebody's burnt it and put it onto YouTube. But I really think that he really didn't get the recognition. Unfortunately, Michael died November 24th, 2003 at the age of 64 due to prostate cancer.
Oh, so, that's quite young.
Yeah, he was really young. He was really young. And it's really sad because he was such a talented composer, but suddenly got attached to these movies, like TV movies he did a lot of, and movies that didn't get the high acclaim.
It's weird because I had a look at his credits on IMDb, and he's done loads of stuff, but it just never quite became that big name. But I agree. I think he did a really good job on the soundtrack for this movie. I think, and we've said this about soundtracks before, that I think a good soundtrack shouldn't really have you noticing it while you're watching the movie.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there were definitely moments where I was watching this movie and thinking, oh, that music is really doing it.
Yeah.
It's kind of, you know, it enhances the scene. The more perilous scenes, I suppose, are the ones where you notice it more because you get the classic Jaws theme. Hmm. But I think the way he used John Williams' theme...
100%.
...very effective in this movie.
Yeah, he just didn't kind of like, you know, he didn't plagiarize John Williams' score. I think there's hints of it in there, and I think he can, an aspect of it, I think he improved a lot of it because I think he has a lot more emotion to it because everybody so knows the Jaws music so iconically that to bring a fresh breath of fresh air, I think he really didn't, he kind of like gave a new level to it that I don't think was there before. Like there was a lot of emotion in there. Actually, when they released the promo of this, the soundtrack out, he was still alive and he, lots of soundtrack magazines and websites and stuff reviewed it and they gave him really good reviews, like 3 out of 5, 4 out of 5 scores. What was quite good because he probably worked really hard on this soundtrack. He probably got that film and footage and he was sitting there with these whole orchestra and they're looking at this plastic shot bubble on. Why? And he probably turned it around really quickly as well. And I think he did a great job. I really do. I think it's I think it's a shame that we do, a lot of people don't recognise it. And Universal, if you're listening, why don't you just release a box set of LPs and CDs, mainly LPs, because that's really fashionable at the moment, to of all the soundtracks together, like have all the scores on massive box set of like Jaws, Jaws 2, Jaws 3 and Jaws 4, because all of them have superb soundtracks. Even Jaws 2 was done by John Williams as well, so why wouldn't you take advantage of that situation and like box them up? People will buy these. People will buy them. Get them on an LP. Even if you want to do something helpful, donate some money to prostate cancer so Michael Small is remembered.
Yeah. Do it. Do it, Universal.
So, Claire, how many roaring sharks would you give Jaws of Revenge?
Well, it's a tricky one. I have thought long and hard, and I've changed my mind a few times as well. I think I'm going to give it 2 out of 5.
Okay.
I think if you just take it at face value and enjoy it for what it is, there is a lot to enjoy in this movie. But it just takes so much suspension of disbelief to get to that point where you can just sit back and enjoy it.
Yeah.
And I think you have to factor that in, or I have to factor that in my scoring. I think it's asking a lot of the audience to kind of suspend disbelief quite that far. So for me, it's a 2 out of 5. But I have to say, I mean, that feels very low. That equates to what, 40%. Yeah. So it's still double that IMDb audience score.
Yeah. No.
So I still, you know, I'm rating it much higher than almost everyone in the world.
Yeah.
Apart from possibly you. What's your score?
Well, I, you know, before we move on to that, I just want to say, like, for somebody who's not been a Jaws fanatic, as I have throughout my whole life, for this is the first time watch for you, for yeah. you to come away from it as 2 stars and not just fall down the sinkhole that happens when you people Google this movie, or that most people take their first gut reaction when they see this and they know it's a 0% Rotten Tomatoes going in, and to have you be honest and give it 2 scores, I really appreciate that as a fan of Jaws.
I don't think it's a bad movie at all.
No, it's not.
It's not a great movie at all, but no. it's not that bad a movie. I genuinely still don't understand how it's got such bad ratings.
It's just because it follows Jaws, and Jaws is so iconic and Oscar winning.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You know, they took the franchise. If Jaws was a shit film in the first place and didn't get the recognition as it did, then the people wouldn't be so hard on Jaws Revenge, I don't
yes.
think.
I mean, this is nowhere near the standard of Jaws.
No.
But
exactly.
Equally, we scored, I mean, we didn't score Jaws, the original Jaws, because it's not a sequel. But when we did Jaws 2,
yeah.
I should have listened back. I can't remember, but we were scoring it. I think I scored it 4 and you scored it 5.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
Yeah, something along those lines. I think it was like, I was like 4.5. I knocked it down for not being the original.
You know,
apart from that,
this movie is not as good as that movie. I'm not scoring it anywhere near as high as that, but it's not a 0% movie. It really isn't.
So for me, as someone who grew up with this, and for someone who has been obsessed with Jaws for the last 38 years of my life, since I was probably old enough to watch Jaws at an early age of like 5 or 7.
I was just doing the math of that. I was like, really? You were watching Jaws at age 5?
Yeah, because my parents, I always liked horror. My parents didn't have any issue with it. It was a PG. So it was just something everybody was like,
it was the 80s.
And
times were different.
You're a parent today, not a parent back then. People didn't like, you had four TV channels. And if your kids weren't leaving you alone, you didn't give a fuck what they were watching. They're they're not leaving me alone. I don't care. So I'm going to give it 3.5 stars. It's not perfect, but I think the cast does a great job driving the emotion forward within the movie, because the shark's not in it that much. You know, I think it paints a really good view on the Bahamas. It doesn't give that glossy tourism view we usually get in movies. It's quite rough. And I think it really does paint the Bahamas and what it's like to be there. You know what? Oh, fuck it. I'm going to give it 4 stars out of 5. I really like this film. I really like this film. I don't have an issue with it. I know the shark looks plastic, but the shark looks plastic in all the movies. If somebody, like, there's a couple of deep fakes on the YouTube where people have re-edited it and, like, the CGI shark in it and got rid of some of the plastic scene sharks. And there must be for somebody to spend that much time doing that for this film, there's a fan base for this movie. There's definitely, I like this film. I never find it boring. I watch it yearly. I'm far more entertained about it. I find it more entertaining than 3 and sometimes 2. It's, and at 90 minutes, it's, you know, I'm not saying it's as good as 2. 2's a much better made movie.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. But like, as a footprint to the original film, this has more in common with the original film than emotionally driven characters than 2 and 3 does.
Yeah.
And
definitely 3.
Oh my God, yes.
question.
You haven't listened to our Jaws 3D episode. Go back and listen to that. So, Claire, now we've wrapped up the Jaws franchise, what is your...
You're assuming there's not going to be a fifth instalment.
I don't think
it could happen.
I would be happy for them to make another Jaws movie. The problem is, B-movie marketplace is flooded with shark movies.
Yeah.
And it'd be really difficult for them to step out of that. Even the one of my favourite shark movies is Deep Blue Sea.
Mm-hmm.
And now that just has a loads of spin-off straight to DVD / sci-fi channel sequels. You've got Sharknado, you've got all these.
Yeah.
There's so many shark movies out there. The Shallows was really good with Blake Lively. Have you watched that one?
I haven't.
Oh my God, you should watch that. It's an amazing film. But the market is flooded. And if they came up with something original, like taking down Spielberg's original idea of basing it on the Indianapolis, the story from the original Jaws movie, he wants to make that into a movie. I think that you can roughly say the Shark Jaws franchise is properly to bed. And if they did do it now, they would CGI the fuck out of that shark.
That's true. It would, they would CGI it, and all the fans would be really upset.
Yeah, you know how
it was effects rather than practical.
And if they, you know, to me, how can I refer this to Claire? Do you remember when we went and watched the prequels to the Star Wars movies and they CGI Yoda?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember how you felt?
Mm-hmm.
That's how I would feel if they CGI Jaws.
I'm using the Force to suppress my rage at the moment.
I remember your face. You're like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah, okay. All right. Point taken. Moving on. No more Jaws sequels. Let's not mess around with it.
No. Leave it where it is. So, Claire, what is your order of the Jaws movies? Also including the original, even though we haven't covered it.
Okay. Well, I mean, Jaws is the original and best of the four, I think, hands down.
Yeah.
That said, Jaws 2, and I said this when we covered it, is a fantastic movie. If Jaws, if the original Jaws didn't exist, everyone would love Jaws 2.
Yes,
even 100%. More than you do. Mm-hmm. So Jaws 1, Jaws 2, very close behind. And then quite a big gap. And then Revenge. And then 3 at the bottom, or 3D, or whichever, depending on how you watch it. I think that there is a gap. I'm not saying that Revenge is almost as good as 2, because it's not.
No.
There is a little gap in the middle. But I would rate, well, and I have, based on my scores, Revenge higher than 3D. Not by a huge amount, but 3D is just a bit weird. 3D, it doesn't sit within the franchise.
No.
And actually, you know, it's been excluded, but with the extension of the franchise into Revenge, it kind of got pushed out anyway. So maybe I would feel differently about 3D if Revenge didn't exist.
Yeah.
But even if they hadn't pushed it out of the franchise, I would think I would still feel like it doesn't sit well.
I agree.
The other three, the original 2 and Revenge, for me, they sit together as a set. Obviously, the quality is not the same across all three in terms of the how good the film is, but the feel of the film, the vibe of the film, the continuity is kind of there between those three. And 3D doesn't really fit into that.
No, I agree.
For me. I mean, like I said in the 3D episode, I think I would enjoy 3D more as a standalone.
Yeah.
Than I do.
It doesn't need to. The way they took that movie, they didn't need it to be the Brody family. If they wanted to do something with that movie and label it as Jaws, they could have taken a sidestep and done another bunch of people. It didn't have to. My personal opinion, as much as I love Revenge because I grew up with it and I like seeing those characters characters on screen. Jaws 3D would have been a great way to step away from the Brodies. The Brodies story should have been wrapped up at the end of 2.
Yeah.
And if they wanted to go down
Florida.
Well,
it's a bit like, it's like when we did, way, 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 way back, when we did Nightmare on Elm Street, Freddy's Revenge. That movie now sits so far outside of the franchise. But when it was made, it was supposed to be a kind of change in direction for the franchise.
Yeah.
And then it didn't go well. And they went, oh, let's just take it back where it was. And so now that movie becomes an outlier. I think that might be what's happened to 3D.
Yeah.
Here. They maybe were trying to take a different direction. And I think I agree with you. I think if they were going to change direction, they should have changed it more and not included the Brodies at all, maybe.
Yeah.
But then they backtracked and Revenge pulls it back into that continuity, which kind of elbows out 3D. Mm. So, which is a shame for 3D, but it is the weakest. For me, the weakest of the four movies. How about you? Do you agree or would you position
it different? No, I would position it exactly the same. Without the big gap in between, I would literally go Jaws, Jaws 2, Jaws of Revenge. And a little wee gap to 3D. I always... 3D never appealed to me. I didn't see it. No one saw it in 3D until they got the real 3D Blu-ray a couple of years ago, about 5-6 years ago it came out on Blu-ray. Before that, everybody that was exposed to it on home release who wasn't old enough to see it in 1983 has just had weird watching a weird film that had blurry picture and a bending arm sticking out, you know, like just floating in mid-space. And I think that really represents their reputation. I actually believe... that the Jaws, a lot of people blame Jaws of Revenge for killing the Jaws franchise, but I think it was dead on arrival. I think Jaws 3D killed the Jaws franchise, and they just tried. They tried doing what Halloween has done, trying to revamp it and redirecting it, and it didn't work.
Yeah,
but like if they did Jaws 1, Jaws 2, and then did Jaws 3D. And then left it, and then in today's world did Jaws of Revenge, I think it would be a huge hit, because we're now in that period where we want nostalgia and we like watching those movies.
Well, yes, and there's reboots coming around all over the place.
Mm.
I think it might work. It might have worked better now.
So that wraps up Jaws of Revenge.
Does. Listeners, please take a moment to rate us and don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any new episodes. And tell us what you thought of Jaws the Revenge. You can leave us a comment. You can email us on unlovesequels@gmail.com and find us on all the socials at unlovesequels.
So it's goodbye from me, Michael.
And me, Claire.
Take care, guys.
Okay! How the hell you do that, man? It wasn't easy, believe me.
Come on. You alright, man?
Bloody hell.
Get us started, double time.
The breath on that thing.
You are alive.
Oh, let's get out of here, Alan Brody.